So thank you to all of you who have come to this teleconference today on copyright and accessible alternative formats. I will turn it over to Anthony in a moment, who will introduce himself. But in the meantime, for those of you who are attending for the first time, Braille Literacy Canada holds a teleconference every 2 months on some kind of Braille-related topic. We are always happy to receive suggestions, so if there's a topic you'd like us to cover, you can let us know. Our email address is info@blc-lbc.ca, which all of you have because that's how you registered. The teleconferences are free to any BLC members. If you'd like to learn more about how to become a member, you can go to our website, BrailleLiteracyCanada.ca. So it's an easy website to remember. And the teleconferences are also free to those of you who are members of organizations that are corporate members of BLC. So if you're not quite sure whether you are part of an organization that is a corporate member, you can follow up with us or your corporate or your organization to confirm. And for non-members, the teleconferences are $20. So I'm happy to answer any questions you have about BLC membership. You can write us an email anytime. But thank you for joining us. I hear a few other people have just joined in. So before we begin, I'm just going to ask everyone to mute by pressing *6. And that same number will allow you to unmute yourself as well. So if everyone could just press *6 right now. And there will be lots of time for questions and discussion as well, so just hang on tight. But I think we're very fortunate to have Anthony with us today, who knows a lot about these topics. So I will turn it over to him now to introduce himself and get started. Thank you, everyone.
Good afternoon, everyone, and thanks for joining us today. This presentation is entitled The Copyright Act Demystified for the Production of Alternative Format Materials, but we'll go a little bit beyond that into some other areas as well. By way of introduction, in case anybody is not familiar, I am the treasurer with Braille Literacy Canada. I've been on the national board for a couple of years now, and I also serve as the president and CEO of Media Access Canada, which is primarily concerned with accessibility and ensuring access in broadcasting and telecommunications with the CRTC. I have low vision, but over the years I've also used Braille, screen readers, OCR software, and so I'm familiar with these issues from a number of different perspectives. My day job is as a lawyer in civil and mostly class action litigation, but also some human rights involvement with employment issues, education issues, discrimination when the opportunity presents itself. And so that's the background that I bring to this. The purpose of this presentation is really to provide some general information about the Copyright Act and the implications that it has for the production of alternative format materials, be that in Braille or audio or in other forms as well. The impetus for this really came about because a lot of questions, BLC was, and me as well, have gotten a lot of questions over the years about what can be transcribed or whether you need permission, or the people have assumed that they need permission in order to adapt materials. And there's some conflicting and confusing information out there about what is and isn't required. Irene, I know you mentioned the Marrakesh Treaty. That isn't all that relevant to what we're doing here today, because the Marrakesh Treaty effectively results in some amendments to the Copyright Act to permit the international exchange of materials. So I'm going to be talking quite a bit today about the exemptions that exist in Canada that permit the production of alternative format materials. And the Marrakesh Treaty comes along to try to enable Canada to share that information with other countries and to be able to accept materials from other countries as well. And that, as far as Canada is concerned, has largely been implemented in the legislation. So legally, we're in a position to take advantage of that. I gather the U.S. is getting closer, and that's probably the most significant producer of alternative format materials that there is, and that we stand to get the greatest benefit from. So long as the U.S. wasn't part of this, more likely than not, Canada would be exporting to other countries rather than the other way around. The second piece of legislation that is in the works at the moment, of course, is the Federal Canadians with Disabilities Act, which is, I'm told, going into second reading this coming week sometime, and hopefully will be enacted into law before the next election comes about. That legislation doesn't directly touch on this per se. What it may ultimately do is require federally regulated bodies and companies to have information available in alternative formats and to provide it, particularly on request. The details of that still remain to be seen. We have the legislation, which has general provisions such as information has to be made accessible, but we don't have any regulations yet that specify exactly what that means or how it's supposed to be done or when or what have you. So that's an area where there will probably be some developments in the next year or two as that unfolds. Braille Literacy Canada did submit some recommendations to the government during the consultation process about what that should look like, particularly as Braille is concerned, and we'll be following up with the process that comes now to try to make sure that some of those recommendations actually become a part of it. But that legislation isn't really going to change anything around the legalities of producing alternative format materials or getting permission or anything like that. The one recommendation that we did make and that could be relevant is that any grants or support and money that is provided by the federal government through, for example, grants to publishers be tied to a requirement that whatever comes out of that grant be universally accessible from the get-go. So the idea there is that if a publisher or an author or somebody else is receiving federal funding to produce a work or a series of works, those should be available in alternative format as part of the original production process. Now, we're a long way from seeing whether that will actually make it into the law or the regulations in some way, but it's a thing that we're going to be working on and that going forward could help to alleviate some of the issues that come up here. Two things before I go on. One, to some extent, this is rather technical and deals with the legal interpretations that have been made as far as the Copyright Act goes. But obviously this is very general. Don't take any of this as legal advice for your particular situation, because very often there are little quirks that can change whether something is allowed or not allowed. And if there's any doubt on that, you probably want to get some advice specifically about your circumstance. Secondly, when we get to answering questions and such, one of the things, we do record these teleconferences. to make them available after the fact, which we're working on how to present that, but to make them available after. So these calls are recorded, and if you're making any comments and such, just be aware of that. Now that everybody has successfully muted yourself with star 6, I'm going to make you undo all that. With my first question of the day, which is, who's here? Do we have readers, transcribers, teachers, parents, lawyers? Who do we have on the call? Star 6 will unmute yourself if you are currently muted.
Louise Gillis is here with the Canadian Council of the Blind.
Hi. Is it possible to talk now?
Yes, we can
hear you. Monique Baudouin. I'm a Braille reader, transcriber, and I do everything, almost everything with Braille. And even I taught Braille to a few people.
Kim Kilpatrick, I'm a reader. I guess I don't do any of the other roles. I don't think there's any other status I have for this.
Okay. Anyone else out there? Okay, you're all a little bit shy. Well, we'll have to try to work on that a little bit.
Again, I'm a reader and a transcriber and teacher.
And all of you know me. I'm Natalie, and I'm a reader and a rehab specialist, so I teach Braille as well.
So now I have a couple of other questions. I'll give them all at once, and you can answer whichever ones come to mind. The first one is, how have you learned about the Copyright Act, or what do you even know about it? What kinds of problems or challenges or issues are you seeing or have you experienced? And perhaps most importantly, what do you hope to learn from today? What do you hope to get from this teleconference?
So maybe we can go by province just to see if anyone from that province would like to comment. So anyone from Quebec?
Yes.
Okay. Would you like to respond?
Okay, I think for me it's going to be up-to-date maybe information, because I know a bit about Marrakesh Treaty. I read the things, and I hope that it's going to come in Canada and we might get better. But sometimes I think the problem we have today with the email and the CD and my website, I think that's where the problem is. I don't think for Braille, you transcribe a document in Braille. It's a minority of people, and we probably is going to read it. I never had to do with the process of copyright, because most of the time I transcribe Braille for groups or community group, and I hope we won't have to get around and to have the permission. If people give you like a little contract, it means probably you can do it without any problem. I never asked the stuff. To me, it never came to my mind how to transcribe the stuff, yes or no. And even I do some Braille for sometimes on document or part of document I receive, but it's just for my own purposes. I don't care about the copyright. It's anyway, it's just something I'm going to sell and everybody's going to read. That's why I think we have to be a bit flexible about those things, and who's going to need the document, and is it for yourself, is it for just a small group, or is it for a large number of people? I think that's going to be something very, very important.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. As another Quebecer.
Oh, yeah, go ahead.
I'm more just a user, and I know there are tons of books available in other countries, and often when you're trying to find one in particular, you're told that they can't do it for the copyright law. If I want a Braille map of a certain area, it's always the copyright law when I go to the rehab center. And I guess as a user, I just want to be up to date with my knowledge of what's in that copyright law.
Yeah, I'm kind of like you, Irene. It's Kim, and I'm from Ontario. But you hear rumors about, oh, this will be bad, or this will be good, or this won't be something. So you hear things. I guess my earliest problem with the copyright law was in a course I took in university. Well, copyright. I won't say the law, just copyright and materials. I was so all of the materials for that course were handouts, no textbook. The prof collected everything in an envelope for me. I took it to the center to be brailled and or recorded for me. And at the start of school, I came and they said, no, we couldn't do any of those because of the copyright. Like, we didn't have copyright on any of them. And they didn't call me to tell me that, so I started with nothing and had to scramble. So that was my first sort of run-up with that kind of a situation. And it's, but now I think it's sort of rumor, and I'm trying to figure out what, how does it work, and how do we know when something is, and what to do about it when we come up against it. That's what I would say.
Okay.
Thanks, Monique, Irene, and Kim. All really good points. Do we have any teachers here, just from anywhere in Canada? Any teachers who want to comment on what they hope to gain from today or their experience with copyright in the past? Any?
Okay, well, okay. Those are things that I think we'll be able to shed a little bit of light on as we go through here. So, first of all, be careful about Google. If you try to find answers to these questions, one of the problems with searching on the web is, one, it's sometimes hard to tell whether the answer you're finding actually has anything to do with Canada or whether it's related to somewhere else like the U.S. And two, there were some significant changes to the Copyright Act in 2016 that information you find on the web may not necessarily be reflecting. In 2016 is when the Marrakesh Treaty was implemented, the Copyright Act, to allow for easier sharing with international bodies. And there were some other consequential changes that were made at the same time that a lot of online resources and information that are posted there now don't account for. The most significant change is that prior to 2016, it wasn't necessarily legal to make large print copies of a book. You could transcribe into Braille, you could transcribe, or you could prepare audio copies, but if all you needed to do for a person was to enlarge the text and print it on larger paper, that was not included in the automatic exemptions. And so, technically, you, in order to do that, you had to go back to the publisher and get permission to do it for each and every book that came along. That's no longer the case. Large print copies can now be made without having to go back and seek permission for that. Any adaptations to videos or movies, though, still require permission of the copyright owner, which creates that could be a problem if somebody's trying to prepare a described video version of a production, because those you still need to go back and get permission before doing anything. So a word that comes up all through the legislation when we're talking about this and the exemptions is perceptual disability. And this, according to the law, means a disability that prevents or inhibits a person from reading or hearing a literary, musical, dramatic, or artistic work in its original format, and includes such a disability resulting from severe or total impairment of sight or hearing, or the inability to focus one's eyes, the inability to hold or manipulate a book, or an impairment related to comprehension. That's pretty broad. Of course, from a Braille perspective, the only thing that's really of concern is the severe or total impairment of sight or hearing, of sight rather. But you'll see that this exemption potentially applies to people in other situations as well, with various physical disabilities or even intellectual disabilities if it's a matter of needing material in audio rather than print form, for example. Now, the government has enacted what's known as Section 32 of the Copyright Act, and this is the perceptual disability exemption. So, ignoring all the filler words that they put into this, what it boils down to is that it is not an infringement for a person with a perceptual disability, for a person acting at the request of a person with a perceptual disability, or for a not-for-profit organization acting for the benefit of such a person to reproduce these works in a format specially designed for persons with a perceptual disability. Now, we're going to go through that in some smaller chunks and take out what that actually means in practice. But this applies to books, music, artistic and dramatic works. It can also apply to certain sound recordings. And in the 2016 amendments, they also added that it wasn't an infringement to provide a person with a perceptual disability with or to provide access to any of these works. Now, we'll come back to that, because that suggests that if you've got it in an alternate format, you can give people access to it regardless, you know, on a carte blanche scale. In other words, if you've got a Braille copy, you can give it to anybody with a perceptual disability and there's no issue. Of course, they can't make it as simple as that. There's an exception to the exception. And that exception is that this does not apply if the work is commercially available in a format specially designed to meet the needs of the person with a perceptual disability. As a transcriber or somebody who's producing material in an alternate format, this puts an obligation on you to determine whether there already is an existing accessible copy that can be purchased off the shelf. And commercially available means either it's available in Canada within a reasonable time and for a reasonable price, or you can find it with some reasonable effort. And of course, this gets down to what's reasonable. What's a reasonable price? What's a reasonable time? That's going to depend very much on your circumstances. If it's a student starting a course in 2 days, the fact that a book could be obtained in 3 months isn't going to solve your problem. The second thing is that it has to be available in a format designed to meet the needs of the person. So this isn't necessarily the format that the person wants. An audio recording may technically be argued to be in a format that meets the needs of a blind person, even though they want Braille. So if you're reproducing material into Braille and you're aware that an audio recording already exists and could be purchased on the open market, whether that be from Audible or Chapters or Amazon, what have you, as a transcriber, it would be a good idea to keep records of what was transcribed and why you did it in that format and why audio wasn't good enough. Because obviously there is some material that is going to be far more useful in Braille. Math textbooks come to mind. It could be done in audio, I suppose, but it's most people probably aren't going to want it in that format. And that would be a justification for producing a Braille copy, even though there already is a accessible copy available. So let's go back to Section 32. It starts by saying it's not an infringement of copyright, and then it lists three different groups that are protected from any accusations of infringement when making alternate format materials. The first is a person with a perceptual disability. So you as an end user can make your own accessible copies of whatever. There's nothing stopping you from scanning your book to get it in a text format or producing Braille from that. The second is a person acting at the request of such a person. So you can ask a friend or a family member to do it for you. You could ask somebody at your workplace to do it for you. And that keeps them in the clear for doing any of this work. The third exemption is a nonprofit organization acting for the benefit of such a person. So not-for-profit organizations can produce alternative format materials, whether or not any specific individual has requested it. And this is how organizations like the CNIB Library operate, in the sense that they're not-for-profit entities, so they can produce alternate formats for the benefit of the blind community and others without needing to go back and get permission to do that. This leaves some uncharted waters when you're acting at the request of an end user, though. So, can you charge somebody for doing this? I said that, if you ask your friend to do it, they're fine. What if you pay that friend? They're still doing it at your request, but it's not entirely clear whether there's an assumption that this is being done for free or not. And similarly, there's an exemption that allows nonprofit organizations to do this for the benefit of the community. When could a company be hired by an individual person to make an accessible copy at the request of that individual person? Because they're not a nonprofit, but they might be considered a person acting at the request of someone with a perceptual disability. So these are two areas where it's really unclear. I think for the most part, companies have tried to stay clear of charging for this kind of thing on an individual basis, because it's hard to know how that will be interpreted. But of course, certainly there are producers out there that take requests from schools and universities and such to produce things in alternative formats, so it's a bit of an open question. The second part of this exemption that can come up and potentially bite a transcriber is that the legislation says it has to be transcribed into a format specially designed for persons with a perceptual disability. Well, there are some clear examples of this. Braille, whether it's in paper copy or a BRF file that you're going to read on your Braille display, is obviously a format that's specifically designed for somebody with a disability. Similarly, sign language is pretty clear-cut. The DAISY format, which for audio and text, probably also is fairly clear-cut. underlying those DAISY CDs in most cases are just plain MP3 files that aren't particularly designed for people with disabilities or anything, but the whole package, including the table of contents and being able to navigate and such, that whole DAISY package probably is a fairly clear case of a format specially designed. And so that's probably fine. Bookshare is an interesting example because some of their formats are obviously specially designed for people with perceptual disabilities, but others, like plain text files, maybe not so much. Then there are examples that are probably fine. A PDF or a Word document that has been transcribed from a print book, but where it's been reformatted to ensure that all the navigation elements are there, or that things in sidebars are part of the main text so that you won't miss them. You know, that's some work that's been done to make it specifically accessible to you, probably fine. Where you can run into problems are things that aren't particularly limited to the blind community. So plain old audiobooks in MP3 format, there's nothing really special about that. So one could ask the question of whether getting a reader to simply record your book into an MP3 file, whether that counts as a specially designed format or not. Plain text files or simple Word documents, there again, maybe yes, maybe no. Direct PDF scan, so if you just scan an entire book as a PDF file and store it like that with nothing more, probably not. That could run afoul of this format specially designed requirement. And then there's the curious addition that they made in 2016 along with the Marrakesh Treaty that says it's not an infringement to provide a person with a perceptual disability or to provide access to a work or other subject matter in a format specially designed for persons with a perceptual disability, and do anything else that's necessary for that purpose. So what does providing access to a work mean? Does that suggest that user A could provide access to alternative format materials to user B without necessarily making another copy? Does that mean that once you have an accessible copy, you can give it to any other person who has a perceptual disability free and clear? There's no limits on how often that can be shared or with how many people? Over the years, we've sometimes seen institutions and publishers and such adopt a one book, one copy requirement. So the Copyright Act itself is completely silent on any conditions for making an alternate format. It's silent on any restrictions on providing access to that approach. So a common sense approach has been taken by many institutions, which tends to be, so long as you have in your control a copy of the original book, they'll give you the accessible copy. And so you end up with students going out and buying another copy of the same textbook in order to get the accessible copy, which the university already has and is just sitting on a hard drive somewhere. Assuming that purchase is required at all, and as I say, there's nothing in the Copyright Act that specifically says that, then purchasing any variety of that book ought to be enough. New or used, print, ebook, Kindle, very often institutions say it isn't. They say, no, you've got to go to the bookstore and spend $144 on the hard copy book. The fact that you could buy the same thing for $49 on Kindle, that doesn't matter. It doesn't count. Well, I don't know where that comes from because it's certainly not part of the Copyright Act. And it's not... And that's not necessarily how entities are actually behaving. I mean, look at Bookshare or Sella, which was previously the CNIB library. They provide unlimited copies to patrons on demand, in most cases, for most of their books. Nobody has to go out and buy an original. And then we have... arbitrary limitations that institutions try to put on alternative formats. The Alternative Education Resources Center for Ontario, or AERO, says in their materials that, quote, books that you downloaded must be deleted from the storage site at the school and deleted under the student's holdings at the end of the school year, unquote. Well, where does this come from? If I go buy a book from Chapters, scan it, leave it on my bookshelf, there isn't any arbitrary time limit after which I have to delete the scanned copy because it's, I don't know, gone Cinderella and turned into a pumpkin. There's nothing in the legislation that deals with this. And I ran into this when I was in law school, actually, with... a publisher that it was a reference book, one that, you know, once you buy, you probably keep for the next 5 years, at least until the next edition comes out. And I wrote to the publisher and said, you know, it would be very helpful if you could send an electronic copy to save me ripping this one apart and scanning 400 pages. And they replied and said, oh, no, we can't deal with you. You have to go through your school. Well, all right. So I went to see the Office for Students with Disabilities and had the person there send exactly the same email I sent, to which they got back a contract, which I was supposed to sign and agree to, which said that they would provide an electronic copy. Note that this is just an electronic copy, not necessarily an accessible electronic copy. But that I could only keep it for 4 months, and then I would have to delete it unless I entered into yet another contract with them to continue reading the same book. And the impression that all of this leads is that organizations that deal with copyright, like Access Copyright or the publishers or even alternative format resource centers, they're layering or adding their own ideas to the restrictions that should exist around alternative format production. And this just isn't in the law. It isn't. And when people and students and such are running into these problems, the only thing that really we can do is try to push back and try to educate these publishers that they don't have the right to impose additional restrictions on what we do with the alternative formats once they're made, or indeed to make them in the first place. There are, some of it is ignorance. I had another publisher, this was a novel, and I asked if we could get an electronic copy. And I told them outright that, you know, if you don't send an electronic copy, I'm going to have to dismantle this book that I've already bought and scan it and read it. Their response was to apologize profusely for the fact that they could not do what I asked, but they would send me a free copy of the book as a show of goodwill. So I ended up with two copies of the book, one for free, but still no accessible alternative. In this sense, publishers are really kind of your nemesis. In a lot of cases, it would be much easier, much quicker, and much more reliable to produce an alternative format or a Braille copy from an electronic original. You don't have to scan all the text and clean that up. And yet publishers are often very reluctant to provide electronic copies. They'll give away print copies. Even if you tell them that ultimately you're going to have to scan it all anyway and then you will have an electronic copy, they still don't move. And this is really coming down to education, and probably at some point some enterprising person coming along and actually wanting to take it to court and try to make a point of it. That's bound to be a big and long fight, and so far nobody has really taken it on. One of the difficulties is that these provisions, they exist, and they've existed for years, but they've really never been tested. Nobody's ever really tried to see where those limits are. So we don't know exactly, but what we do know is that a lot of these restrictions that come along are not part of what the legislation actually says. Another area that sometimes comes up, and that you, as a transcriber or as a student you may need to be aware of, is that individual teachers or professors may try to give effect to their own copyright on their own materials, like PowerPoint presentations or exam guides. As with publishers, some are reluctant to provide electronic copies. They express a concern that those might be shared or be widely distributed, and somehow they will lose out on that in the end. And this can create real accessibility barriers. If you can't get the slides in advance and you're trying to follow a presentation without that, education is really the key here in terms of informing them that one way or the other, you're going to get the content, whether from them or whether from some other source, and they're really just making it more difficult for you to get to the same end goal. Most people probably won't have any trouble agreeing, for example, that if electronic copies are provided, they won't be shared beyond yourself with other students or what have you. That's fine, but there's no real ground to prevent alternate format versions from being produced. And so whether you're a transcriber or a reader, whether you work in a school environment or in higher education, what you can take from all of this is that the Copyright Act really ought not to be a barrier to obtaining alternate format materials or producing them. In some limited cases, video and audio, permission might still be needed to make alternative format productions. For most other items, be it books or articles or in-class materials, there is nothing stopping the institution from producing alternative format materials without having to jump through any major hoops. And similarly, requirements from publishers that you agree to arbitrary restrictions on what you can do with it and how long you can keep it and such, there's no legal basis for that. And pushing back is the only way we're going to really educate publishers into understanding that they can't do these kinds of things. Unfortunately for students, it's very often difficult to push back because you need the information then, you don't have time for a fight, and if you say no, they might not give it to you and you'll be at a disadvantage. So we understand that, but this is one of those things that, perhaps as an organization and as these situations arise, we can do a little bit more about. So now I'll open it up to see, are there other situations that you can imagine where this comes up? Do you have any examples of issues? Do you have any questions about where this takes us and what we can do about it? We can start from the West Coast, I guess, and anybody out there and go east from there?
Hey, Anthony, it's Adam from Vancouver. Sorry, I didn't have a chance to introduce myself earlier.
Hello there.
Hi. Just to speak to one of the points that you brought up earlier around the limitations or the stipulation that the files received from an alternate format material resource center be deleted at the end of the year. While just in our experience in BC, one of the main reasons, well, there's two main reasons that we would do that. One is so that files are kind of continually being upgraded in terms of the quality. And so we tell folks that they need to be deleted and re-downloaded because they might be available with a better markup. And the other piece to that is that it helps with download statistics, being able to show the effectiveness of the service. And the third piece is that what we find is that when digital alternate format materials accumulate at school or at school district level, what ends up happening is that the kind of little like mini repositories start to form. And of course the challenge with those is that there's less control over the appropriate use of those materials in terms of student use covered under the Copyright Act. And so I guess that's just kind of adding our perspective to that point.
Okay. Anybody else in BC, Alberta, Manitoba, Saskatchewan? Okay, Ontario folks.
Question. Oh, no, go ahead. Where are you going?
Sorry, it's Jen. I was just going to ask, had we moved on to Ontario? Because I unmuted and...
Yeah, we did.
...did a lady tell me that I was unmuted, kind of blocked out answers.
Yes, go.
You go ahead, Jen.
Okay, I just wanted to ask, and I apologize if you covered this. It's a lot of information. It's really good information. I found this quite fascinating. But anyway, so... One of the issues that I'm sure has come up for a lot of us is the fact that in the U.S. there's so, like, the Library of Congress has so many books and, you know, we can't get them. Although the CNIB seems to be able to get copies of books from the U.S. and the U.K. because I don't know about the rest of you, but I grew up reading the, you know, EA contracted and no caps and things produced in the U.K. and, you know, so on. So I guess what I'm kind of trying to ask in a not very cohesive way is, how does all that you've just said sort of come into play when it comes to cross-border stuff? Like, is it just that you're talking about Canadian copyright law and this is U.S. copyright law? Like, I understand that there's sort of a, you know, copyright laws are different in different countries, so I just sort of wondered if you could address that at all, if that made any sense.
Yeah, so this exemption and such is really about producing stuff in Canada for a Canadian.
Okay,
that's what
I thought. It
doesn't particularly matter where the original book came from, but those are the kinds of issues that Marrakesh will hopefully help to deal with in terms of opening up those lines. You know, RNIB, there has certainly been some sharing of materials between Canada and the U.S. and Australia and the U.K. over the years. But I'm guessing that people have to go back and sort of get permission from the publishers and such to do that at the time. Marrakesh will make it much easier for that to happen without having to go back and get permission to do that on a book-by-book basis. So as the U.S. gets on board with that, maybe, you know, the Library of Congress may not want to deal directly with Canadians because of the logistics of it, but it may be that you'll be able to get requests right through Seller or something down the road. So we'll see how that evolves, but hopefully Marrakesh will open up a lot of those other resources, particularly for things like Braille, although now Seller's not really archiving that. They're doing it on a one-off basis, so unless other libraries also go to that route, I don't know logistically how that will work in terms of getting Braille books from the U.S., but it should soon become possible.
Thanks.
I had a question for you, Anthony. So I don't know if everyone on this call knows, but Sila is now producing a single-use Braille. So you request a book in hard copy Braille, and you get it in the mail, and not bound quite the same way, like just sort of stapled together volumes, but you can then either recycle it yourself or keep it. But I'm presuming that if they go to the trouble of brailing a book for me and, say, Jen, because we live in the same city, wants to read it, if I give it to her once I have it, even though, you know, it came from Sila and technically a library book, because of the things you said about the specific formats and because it's, like, it's my copy now, is that... how would it go of that? Or even if we, would it be different if we created like a library book that all the blind people in Ottawa could borrow from our Sila single-use Braille? It just seems a shame to do the single-use Braille and kind of throw it out, but I don't know if there's anything you want to say on that. I don't know.
It's interesting that, I mean, with that, they're not archiving it anymore, so they're just sort of making as many copies as they need. But they've always been doing that with the books as well.
But I had to return those, though, right?
Like, well, yes, at which point they just recycled the CD and you know, didn't do anything with it particularly, so I don't know. Back in the day of tapes, obviously they went back and then were reissued to the next person, so they needed to keep them around. But we, as with everything else, we've gone into this disposable society. The way it reads, it says that if it's not an infringement to provide anybody with a perceptual disability with access to an alternate format book. So this is all sort of untested, but there doesn't seem to be anything stopping you from giving your Braille copy to the next person if they're also, you know, entitled to have access to that.
As long as you don't try to sell it.
Yeah, where you might get into issues is if you're renting them out or trying to make money off of them, that could be a different kind of problem.
Yeah, that's what I kind of thought, but I mean, it does seem a shame if I'm reading something and someone says, oh, I'd like to read that I can't, you know, pass it to them when I'm finished with it.
I mean, if you think of the sighted world, I mean, it works the same way.
Why do people share books all the time?
Mm-hmm.
In this case, I mean, if you want to be cynical about it and think of it from the author's point of view, it does seem slightly unfair that Sela can come along and just produce 2 million Braille copies of the book without ever paying anything for it, that then stay in existence forever. But I think this is one of those cases where the legislators figured that the trade-off in terms of providing access was worth what little dent it might make on anybody's profit.
Such a small population,
yeah.
Too, that...
If I may, it's Albert.
Yes.
I just wanted to say about the audio books, the Daisy books, the only thing that Sheila wants is the envelope, really, because the book goes through, the disc goes through a scraper that just destroys the disc, because the way it's sent to you is your name and address is printed on the disc itself. That's why they ask you to turn the disc around so that your address is hidden, and then the Sheila address on the back of the envelope goes back to them.
That's why I got rid of getting those. I just download. But the single-use Braille I do like because,
yeah.
You know, that's a bit...
But I'm just suggesting, though, that because it's an alternate format Daisy book, and if you kept it, I don't think there'd be any issues with that. Would there, Anthony? And just sent the envelope back?
I don't know if they've ever... Well, I mean, back in the days, they do pursue you if you have too many outstanding
books. Yeah, they would.
Whether they need to is a different question, but I think part of this, like I say, is if you think about it, it seems unfair in some sense. And so they want to not attract more attention from publishers about, you know, to give them an excuse to complain. So this makes it more akin to a regular library, but the single-use Braille is a bit of a different beast, I guess.
Anthony, I have a question. I have many questions, but I'll just keep it to one. I've heard this presentation before, and I always leave learning something new, so this is really good. My question is about the distinction between library books and books that you can purchase. So you mentioned during your talk that one question to consider is whether a book is available commercially in an accessible format. And so many books are also available through your local library in print. So if that book is available in print for sighted patrons, does it follow then that if it's also available for purchase, for example, through Audible or some other audiobook service, that that would be the extent of like you would have to purchase it even though it's freely available to other people?
Well, this is where I say if a book was available commercially like that, yes, you're supposed to buy the commercially available, specially designed format. However, in lots of cases, that may not be suitable. Either because you need the book for more than 2 weeks that the library would give you, or because if it's a school kind of project, you need to be able to reference page numbers or something that isn't going to be in an audio format. And so if you're in the business of transcribing and you just want to cover all your bases, then keeping the justification for not taking that commercially available alternative is probably the way to go. But if it should ever come up, which is probably unlikely.
Doubtful, yeah, exactly.
But, yeah.
And it sounds as though from what you're saying, in terms of there's no onus on the publishers in terms of they're not legally required themselves to provide us with an accessible format.
No. There is nothing at the moment that even takes them down that road. Whether or not somebody could try to use AODA in Ontario as some kind of sword against a publisher to say, you know, if I want a Braille book, you've got to find me a Braille book. The problem right now is there's no way to enforce anything under AODA, so nobody's really tried to challenge that yet. But at the moment, there is nothing to require publishers to get this. The real way to do that is in the school context, for example, if school boards start taking the position that they'll only use, or if professors in a university context take the position that they'll only use a publisher's book if they can guarantee that alternative formats will be available for their students, that's where you can start putting some pressure on them, but there's nothing legislatively that will do it.
Mm-hmm.
Anthony, this is Jen. I know I asked a question already, but I just wanted to clarify something that Natalie had asked. So with regards to the audio version being available commercially, if I, you know, wanted a book in Braille and someone said, well, you know, you have to go with the audio one because that's available in accessible format, but I don't want audio, like, mm-hmm. To me that's sort of them saying, telling me which format I have to use. So are you sort of saying that that's where you can come in and say, well, yes, there is this audio format available. Yes, it's accessible, but it doesn't suit. It's not going to serve the purpose that it needs to serve. I.e., yeah. The person needs to read it. Maybe it's a language book, so they need to actually be able to read it. I just want to make sure I understand that.
Yes. And audiobooks may be the most common thing. Like, this may be kind of as one judge in the Northwest Territories Court of Appeal said about Bell Canada in one case, this may be them worrying about unicorns. In the sense that audiobooks are going to be the most common thing that you're ever going to find that turns out to be commercially available.
Yes.
But audiobooks from Audible can hardly be considered to be in a format specially designed to meet the needs of the person with a perceptual disability.
Because anyone can have them.
Because audiobooks are now so widely accepted by the general public that there's no question that it's not a special format.
Exactly.
So I think probably you're going to be in the clear there.
Okay.
That being said, if there were, if a publisher was selling what they claim to be an accessible PDF, but you needed Braille, that might be, a case where you need to make the case.
Right. Justification.
Yeah.
Can I ask a follow-up question to that?
Oh, yeah.
Are you aware of any precedent or any situation where just that has been the case, that a publisher has actively marketed a format or a specific file as the quote-unquote accessible version, and then that's been challenged and a producer has gone ahead and produced a, I'm using air quotes here, kind of more truly accessible version?
Well, see, I can see this coming up in the future as more publishers start to make e-books and such available that they may claim is, usable by people with disabilities or something.
Right.
I haven't seen any cases there's no case law on this, period. It's just, if this is referenced in some case, it's over some other debate that just sort of gets passing mention.
You know where you do see it? It's Rebecca. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Yes.
You know where you do see it is in an academic context. This just makes me see red. And is when you're talking to university departments, and they'll tell you blithely that blind students use audio on they speak on their computer to access all their stuff. And then you say, well, what do your print reading students use? Oh, well, they use print.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, wow, can we unpack what courses you're insisting? This is where earlier when you said about if a format exists, it's it has to be a reasonable accommodation and all that. It's so problematic because the institutions can prescribe what they think is reasonable accommodation, and if it's a foreign language, as you say, or math, or something, or even higher level philosophy, I don't know where the commas might be important. You can't just say, well, you can read it on your computer. It's something really, really not on about that. I don't know.
And even to take it a step further, even if it's not highly technical material, I think there's a lot that could be said about comprehension and retention and why a Braille user would prefer Braille. So using those kinds of justification, even for leisure reading, I think would make perfect sense in my mind.
How do we deal with this, Anthony? What's the answer? How do we tighten up the legislation?
Well, this is why I'm hoping, with a presentation like this and anything else we can do to get the word out, I'm sort of hoping that if nothing else, when somebody runs into this, they may reach out to us and,
Wouldn't that be good?
Well, when a particular situation comes, we write threatening letters to the publisher about how we're going to see them in court, and then we go from there. You can try to educate as step one, but in a lot of cases, I think it's people mean well, or they've been told somewhere along the line, like you said, they've been told, well, they can just use audio. Well, okay, that solves the problem then. And a lot of it's not understanding that these things are not equivalent. And and this is such a small population it is and it isn't. The learning part of the problem, I think, is that the learning disability community, that has exploded in terms of the number of students that institutions are dealing with, and that might, you know, be, require alternate formats for those reasons, and publishers just don't know how to separate, you know, what is a legitimate use and what isn't, and potentially legitimate cases get caught up in the crossfire here. So as these things come along, you know, we try to deal with it, and if ever there's a way to get a closer connection with publishers, I think we start working on that, you know. It's try to get the education in there, because, yes, institutions very often come back and say, well, the last student didn't need Braille, why do we need
it? Oh, yes. So the follow-up to that is, go ahead.
I got more and more Braille the further I got in university, but it was because I fought for it. I got tired of being told that, you know, I was just going to have to make do with audio, and so I pushed back. But if students don't push back, right, that's, you know, that's...
Well, and most of them don't know that they can. I mean, if they're told, well, the copyright act says we can't do that, well, who's going to argue? I mean, the... And so, you know, we'll try to get the word out there.
Well, and I think you made a good point, Anthony. Like, I was told in first year university, after having used Braille all through high school, that, no, I couldn't get anything in Braille, and I wasn't getting that, and I was getting audio and better be happy with that. And it was either not have it or get audio, and you're in a desperate strait, you need your books now. Like, what are you going to do? I think it's... you know, it's talking to them then about the next year. Like, if someone came to me, now mind you, I went to university back in the day when there wasn't all this as much stuff as there is now, but...
months to get material, Kim.
Yeah, months, and you wouldn't, you know...
Like, who you go to.
And so I think it's educating people in between times. Like, if someone does come in and say, oh, I didn't get anything in Braille, okay, for next year, here's what you need to do now, like start now or something. How did you get more, Jen? Like, would you start really early? That's what I wondered, too.
I started going to my professors directly.
Yeah.
I was very pushy. They did not like me at the Special Services Department at the University of Ottawa because I just argued and pushed, and I complained, and I mean, I was trying not to be a diva throwing tantrums, but I didn't know what else to do because my simple requests were not, you know, my please could I have Braille was just being ignored, so I had to be very, I'm stubborn, as my family will tell you, and that's just what I kept doing. And I was kind of fortunate because I was taking a lot of languages, and so it was a little bit easier to make the case that I needed Braille than if I was doing history or something. I'm not saying that history students shouldn't have Braille. They totally should. But I think in my case it was slightly easier, and they were getting a bit of bad publicity because of me, so they...
Yeah, it helps.
It helps, right? So, unfortunately...
It was a similar situation for me. I would always contact my professors in advance, but it does highlight, you know, when you're thinking about transitioning from high school to university, that especially if students are accustomed to other people dealing with this stuff, they're going to be completely unequipped to handle that, and some people are more natural self-advocates and grow into that, whereas others will not know how to handle it and will just believe, you know, the, quote, older people, right, they have to deal with. So it really raises, you know, even not just making them aware, but maybe even talking them through how they would handle a situation like that before it happens.
Okay, can I ask a question that's more related to the legislation problem?
Yes, go ahead, Irene.
I would like to know, is there another country that has a copyright law that's more progressive than ours? And question B is, what groups do you see working on a copyright in Canada that is going to start some more push for change of legislation?
I don't really know what the international situation is. I know that there was, in terms of Marrakesh, I know that some countries have more restrictive. I think we're probably more on the liberal side of that compared to some, but I honestly don't really know what the lay of the land is outside of Canada and to some extent the U.S. in terms of providing this.
Where do you think the U.S. copyright law stands as far as our needs?
Well, judging from the success of things like Bookshare, they seem to have had fewer roadblocks along the way, which we may now stand to benefit from if Marrakesh actually gets finally approved down there. They're starting down that road, and that could make a big difference for us just in terms of the amount of information that's available, but I guess we'll see. Groups in Canada working on this? Well, I don't know if any of the blindness organizations are doing much of anything, or even if it's an open question of outside of the academic world, to what extent does the average person run into a problem that has to do with the Copyright Act? I don't know. Most people trying to get books probably have the problem of where do you get the book. It's not that they're facing a block because of the legislation. It's because nobody's forcing publishers to make it accessible in the first place,
mm-hmm.
which isn't really part of the Copyright Act. That is probably maybe part of the human rights stuff, maybe a part of the federal legislation. And as more provinces get provincial legislation,
mm-hmm.
That might be the avenue to try to pursue it under. The problem that you run into is publishers don't often sell directly to consumers. And so you don't buy your book from the publisher per se. You buy it from chapters, and can you really make chapters make it accessible? It's a thorny problem.
So it's really not changing the copyright law that we need to be working on. It's getting ourselves together to do some more education and demand our rights.
Yeah, I don't think it's copyright that's getting in the way. I think it's convincing publishers to do it in the first place.
And probably having conversations like the one we're having today at something like a publisher's conference or meeting would be something to consider, because certainly these are all relevant questions and issues for BLC.
That's for sure.
But, you know, I'm even thinking that CELA has been getting ahead of time the list of books that are prize winners and trying to be more relevant in the content they produce. And that would also maybe include single-use Braille. So they may also be a way of helping us get into those library, publisher conferences, or do you know what I mean? Because they would have the way.
Well, it's interesting. CELA seems to have some connections with publishers to get things available when they're released and
such.
The frustrating part about that, and I'm sure that CELA feels the same way, is that they probably wish the publishers would just do it to begin with so that it wasn't up to them to do it afterwards. But baby steps, perhaps, you know.
Can I ask a couple of questions?
Rebecca, could you just hold on to those 1 second? I just want to know, is there someone out there who has not yet had a chance to speak who would like to ask a question at this point? And then we'll go to you, Rebecca. Anyone who hasn't spoken yet who would like to?
I would have a question.
Go ahead, Manny.
About our governmental publications, does we have a legislation about the copyright with regard to order in alternate format or something like that? Sometimes we, anyway, in Quebec and maybe federal too, just to find a person or an organization to find the alternate format is not easy. Who you call, you find the phone number or a website or a site or email at the end of the book if you find it, if you get it first electronically. And I wondered if that would be a comment, why should publishers should have electronic format of their documents. I think that should be the legislation if we want to do something in the accessibility new legislation, federal and maybe provincial, because we have some provincial we have copyright too. It's a suggestion I'm making now. I wonder if we should do something about that to have an obligation about the publisher to have all their documents in its electronic format, and that should be first easier to ask for the format than to ask for a document.
Yes, and again, that comes down to advocating with the government to pass new legislation. You know, it's not a restriction in the existing stuff. This is something that we need a more proactive approach to.
I think we should be more proactive and have a good working on that.
And, of course, government interfering, you know, publishers are private businesses. So convincing government to pass things to force private businesses to do things a certain way is never an easy sell, but with new disability legislation coming out in the various provinces, and unfortunately we get to do this one province at a time, there may be an avenue for that. Rebecca, did you have
I did. I just wondered, can you hear me?
Yeah.
I'm on speaker and I'm not sure whether you're able to.
No, it's perfect.
Okay, so I'm wondering, because it's still, I think I need to re-listen to this teleconference again. I wonder, is there some sort of, do we have a fact sheet? Do we, or could we devise a fact sheet through BLC that we could make available to people that says where the Copyright Act influences or what it does and what it doesn't do? Because I think there's a lot of there's a lot of confusion about that, and the legislation isn't clear on certain things, and it would be good if we could just have in 20 easy bullet points. I don't know, Anthony, is that something that we could work on?
We can consider, yeah, because like as is becoming evident today, you know, there's lots of confusion over what it does and doesn't do, and what problems it creates and doesn't solve. Yeah,
for sure. Yeah, that's a great suggestion. Any other final questions from anyone else?
This is Jen. I just had one comment that just to support what Rebecca said, because I was thinking the same thing that BLC, you know, we've started to try to provide information to people, and so this could be something where we could be a source of information and, you know, all that kind of thing. And then I guess just another quick comment that, you know, for me, one of the things I do a lot is, you know, with my iPhone and my Braille display, I buy iBooks and Kindle books. And one of the things I like is that, yes, I have to pay for them, but I'm paying the same as everybody else, and I'm getting them at the same time. And I guess my point is just I realize that that does affect the landscape of accessible format. And to me, those books become completely accessible, but it's because I have that equipment.
Yes, exactly.
Not everybody does. And my understanding from a work context is that what we tell our customers is that document accessibility, you know, giving me a piece of paper and saying, okay, get an app that you can scan it, that's not meeting the accessibility legislation. That's not meeting their requirements as, say, a bank or an insurance company to provide me. They have to actually provide the format that's accessible. If I have another option that I happen to use, like my use of iBooks or some OCR app, that's all fine and good, but that doesn't absolve them.
No.
It doesn't absolve my bank from having to provide me.
Here.
Exactly, yeah.
So that's it, I'm done. I'm getting down off my soapbox.
No, I'm sure we all agree with you. Yeah, and I mean, what you say is absolutely true, that, you know, those of us who work or are studying are more likely to have access to Braille displays, so things like e-books are often, you know, more usable for us because of that if we would like to read it in Braille. But there's like this whole population that doesn't have access to that yet.
The scanner is not perfect either. When you scan a whole book or even some sheets, there's no progress about the OCR and how to read characters. I see that with years and years. I say that should be improved. I hope these days with iPhone, KFB, I hope it's better, but I'm not sure. And now you see, you have to get the equipment first, and not everybody has the stuff to scan or to read the book.
Yeah, and Braille displays are, you know, we're starting to see lower cost options, but we're not quite there yet. We're heading in that direction, but it's kind of a related thing we need to advocate for when we're thinking about all these questions.
Hi, this is Dwyla. Can I?
Yes, go ahead.
So we were given as teachers, not specifically teachers of the visually impaired, but teachers, a small booklet on copyright. It's called Copyright Matters, Some Key Questions and Answers for Teachers.
Okay.
And so when we're kind of wondering, you know, how far we can go with production and getting copyright and all this kind of stuff, because we do a lot of production right in our office, we'll refer to this. And if there's something that we need to do to make a resource accessible, we sort of always defer to the human rights issue and do they really want to go down that road.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's available online at www.cmec.ca and a couple of other places, and it says it's updated regularly. Like, I've got the print booklet in my hand. So that might be something with BLC that we can have a quick look at and see if there's any, you know, quick points that we can jot down out of there.
That's a great, thank you so much, Dwyla. I'm going to make sure that gets circulated to our members. But I love the suggestions of putting together even bullet points or any existing material that could help give some guidance to people. That's something I think those of us on the board are definitely going to go back and think about more how to incorporate everyone's suggestions here today. So thank you.
Yeah, you're quite welcome.
Great. It's a resource I didn't know about. We still have a few more minutes. This is probably time for one more question. Is there anyone who hasn't spoken yet who would like to comment?
Look, just this is an example of what I mean about careful about the Google. The fourth edition of Copyright Matters was published in August 2016.
Oh.
And it still claims that you can't make large print books.
Mm.
So even though that one gets somewhat regularly updated, it's still not quite up with the latest. But we'll take a look because that looks like it has some other useful information.
Yeah, exactly. We'll put something together for sure. Any final questions? Okay, well, if you do have a question after we end today, you know where to reach us, so you can contact info@blc-lbc.ca and ask any follow-up questions you have. We also recorded the teleconference today, so if you'd like a copy of that to sort through all the information, we'll find a way to get that to you. I also wanted to mention that we will be sending a post-teleconference survey to gather just feedback from today and ways that we can improve in future teleconferences. You'll also have an opportunity to suggest any follow-up topics for future workshops, whether they're related to this or anything else Braille-related. So we're always happy to receive your questions. This was a really, really informative discussion today. I want to thank Anthony for taking the time to speak with all of us today and for everyone for asking such insightful questions. I learned a lot myself. So you can learn more about BLC at BrailleLiteracyCanada.ca. And I want to thank everyone for coming today. And stay tuned for the announcement for our next workshop in roughly 2 months. So coming soon. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you very much. Bye.
Bye.